Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The advantages of breast milk for newborns are well known, and the latest numbers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention illustrate that the message is getting through, but mostly to white women. The number of black women breastfeeding has grown, but as a group, they still lag for many reasons. Kimberly Seals Ehlers is advocates for equity in maternal and infant health and is co-founder of Black Breastfeeding Week. She's the author of 5 books, including the 2017 title, The Big Letdown, How Medicine, Big Business, and Feminism Undermine Breastfeeding. She's also created the concept of the Earth app that enables black and brown women to give Yelp-like reviews of their maternal health experiences with doctors. Welcome to the show, Kimberly.
Thank you so much for having me.
There isn't just one answer to why women of color lag white women when it comes to breastfeeding. So what can you talk about, you know, give us a thumbnail then?
Well, I think that the most important thing that we have to understand is that the disparities that exist are rooted in really racism and what happened to black women when they were enslaved. During that time, black women were actually stopped from breastfeeding their own children, forced to breastfeed the children of their white slave owners, you know, which was clearly a recognition of the value of breast milk, but caused a real disruption in that maternal bond, in that motherhood experience. As we know, black enslaved women could not own their children. They could not protect their children. And so on one hand, they were stopped from breastfeeding their own children, which often, if you look at slave narratives and historical accounts, was to the detriment of their own children. And then in other situations, they were stopped from breastfeeding because breastfeeding can impact and limit your fertility. And so because Black women were viewed as breeders as well, their ability to have more children was often controlled by them not being able to continue breastfeeding. So all of these elements of the racist system have impacted what we continue today, which is, you know, an idea that breastfeeding was something that we did for other people. You know, later, even after enslavement, Black women had very few opportunities for economic advancement and for work. And so wet nursing, being at the service of white women in a paid capacity, was a way that one of the few ways that they were allowed to earn. And so again, this dynamic around the motherhood experience, this dynamic of breastfeeding being disrupted and corrupted and not being a normal maternal thing, we are still dealing with that legacy today. On top of that, we see, you know, a historical lack of education from healthcare providers. And we know that in our country, 60% of infants are born with eligible. And even though WIC in and of itself in many states supports breastfeeding, it is still the largest purchaser of infant formula. And often the perception is that it is free and therefore government endorsed. And so we are battling a lot of nuances around reversing that trend.
And when you talk about that history piece of it, which is so heartbreaking, but so important to understand how it has been imbued into culture and what that means about the decisions we make.
Yes. And I think that we can't ignore the historical trauma of that experience. Certainly, you know, I worked in many projects with different foundations across the U.S. And, you know, Black communities remain highly matriarchal cultures. And so we still have grandparents and great-grandparents who still have this association with breastfeeding as something negative, something we didn't do for ourselves, something that we were demeaned into doing for others. And that discomfort is something that gets passed on. And then on top of that, you know, this began, what happened in slavery began a narrative that said Black women don't breastfeed, our children are sicker, right? And this has continued almost to the point where now we see where Black and brown women, particularly Black women, disproportionately say that their provider didn't even provide them with basic information about it, right? So this idea that Black women don't breastfeed traveled and became truth in many professionals' minds, such that they are not fully supported. And then we look at, when we look at some of the models of support, we know La Leche League being a huge force in this country to support breastfeeding, has fought for legal protections, done so much great work. But we have to also acknowledge that that model was centered in white suburban neighborhoods. And for most of the history, La Leche League focused on supporting mothers who did not work outside the home. And that disproportionately left Black women and other women of color who have traditionally worked outside the home, have had to always work without a key element of peer support. And then that model that La Leche built was used to create other models. It became the thing that was used. And so when we see how a system that included, even the system of support, excluded Black women, and how that has actually become, has been replicated, we understand why we see these pockets. In my work, we've called them first food deserts, and exploring the ways that there are communities that just don't have the supports that mothers need to breastfeed.
When you're talking about how it's, the model's been replicated, are you talking about Lamaze and birthing classes and all of that kind of stuff?
Yes, and the La Leche League model of peer support, right, yeah.
Yeah. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday, and my guest is talking about the issue of the advantages of breast milk for newborns and why and how the message is getting through and when it's not getting through to women of color. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, you know, I grew up, was born into an era where a lot of women, Black and white, did not breastfeed. The formula was being pushed really hard. There were a lot of other bad habits that were condoned during pregnancy and post natal. Something got through more easily to white women than Black women. You've explained the history, which is critical. But what do we know about what is getting through to women of color and what is changing their mind about that? Where are the breakthroughs coming from?
Yeah, that's such a great point. And I think that if we look at, more of a modern thread, one of the things that we know is like breastfeeding had become a fringe culture, right? It was like the hippie people and the tree huggers, quote unquote, right? But what we have seen is the resurgence of breastfeeding, mostly led by white female celebrities, right? And so we can't deny the power of celebrities in terms of, making what's normal, whether we like it or not. And so we've seen a number of white female celebrities who have made breastfeeding now the thing to do. They have advocated for it. They've been on covers of magazines doing it. And that actually helped move the white women away from this idea that breastfeeding was just for the quote unquote tree huggers and into a mainstream celebrity status. And so we did not have the same kind of mainstream movement and acceptance among Black women, right? And so these days it's changing a bit more with some of the younger moms, the millennial moms. We're happy that Beyonce breastfed her babies. We can't wait for Beyonce to keep popping out more children. So we have to, we're looking for more
that poor
Black
woman.
Right, right.
A lot of
we're
pressure.
Looking for more people to be able to do that, because that parade, that constant presence, that normalization that we know, unfortunately, our celebrity culture can do has not happened. And so we've seen that thread be very powerful for white women, but not so much for Black women. And then unfortunately, as you know, we live in the only country that still does not have a federal paid leave. Let's all cross our fingers that it does not get completely decimated in this budget reconciliation, although we've already seen it proposed as scaled back. But without being able to establish breastfeeding, without having that paid leave, and now we know 25% of women in this country go back to work 10 days after giving birth. Is breastfeeding really a choice for those people? And so when we don't have the policy support, now we are looking at who disproportionately is being forced back to work and who doesn't, right? So for those who may have an employer, many employers have stepped in to fill the gap that the federal government has failed to provide to support mothers. And so either you've won the employer lottery or you're stuck going back to work after 10 days. And when we look at the types of jobs, we know that they also disproportionately have women of color who've been at the brunt of the policy gaps in this country. And so again, when breastfeeding has become a class-based privilege or something based on the job that you have and the access to a pumping room and all the things.
To a pump.
Access to a pump, thank you. All of these things have disproportionately harmed Black women and other women of color.
What do you see? What's your strategy overall for changing that dynamic? I mean, are you working with La Leche League? You're starting your own organizations, your own? Is there a way to break through?
Yes, there is. I mean, as you mentioned, I am one of the co-founders of Black Breastfeeding Week, which, you know, this year we celebrate our 9th year. We're heading into our 10th year. And I think Black Breastfeeding Week was created as a time to celebrate Black breastfeeding and to shift that narrative to say, actually, we do breastfeed. And we are working to shift that narrative to raise the presence and visibility of breastfeeding in our community, which has been suffocated and destroyed. And so we are doing that. So many other organizations are doing that. The Black Mothers Breastfeeding Association, based in Detroit, led by Kidada Green, reaching our sisters everywhere. The Rose Organization, led by Dr. Kimmery Bug. Oh my goodness, so many organizations, such great research being done on Black breastfeeding. So the tide is shifting. And also the power of social media. We know that we've been able to raise the visibility of Black breastfeeding simply by having tools where you can see it, right? And so, you know, breastfeeding in our community may have been invisible before, but there is a vibrant Black Women Do Breastfeed Facebook group. There's a Black Mothers Breastfeeding Club on Instagram. I mean, if you just put in Black breastfeeding and watch the scroll appear for yourself, you can see that the narrative is shifting. And this is the beginning of how we change patterns, is by first, you know, telling our story ourselves and giving Black breastfeeding visibility.
I'm eager to see what kind of impact this might have long term on mortality rates for Black babies, which are terrible in Columbus. It's one of the worst in the country. And also another factor in all of this is who is the healthcare provider that's helping guide new mothers or expecting women who are expecting, what does an increase in the number of healthcare providers who are also of color going to make? What kind of difference that's going to make?
Mm-hmm. Well, to your first point, I think the one thing that we have to always remember is that, you know, part of the big reason why I got into Black breastfeeding advocacy was really related to the high infant mortality rates. And it's a function of actually going one step earlier, which is how Black women give birth. So Black women in this country disproportionately give birth to babies who are born too small, too sick, or too soon, despite receiving prenatal care, despite going to all the doctors, despite. It is a function, as we now know, of a weathering concept, the impact of racism that actually tears down our bodies, right? Hope your viewers will Google weathering and learn about that impact on Black birth outcomes.
Yeah, we've talked about it. Yeah.
So because Black women are, through, you know, despite their best efforts, more likely to have a baby who was born too small, too sick, or too soon, those babies need breast milk the most. And many of the reasons why those babies don't make it to their first birthday have many of those risks, whether we're talking about respiratory illnesses, underdeveloped gastrointestinal diseases, many of those things can be mitigated and reduced by breast milk, right? As that first food, as that first preventive medicine, as that first opportunity for optimal health. And so that is why it is so critically important that we talk about breastfeeding, particularly for Black women who are disproportionately having babies who need it the most. And so that's the key piece that, you know, I want to remember.
You know, and then as far as who's the healthcare providers and what role that plays in all of this?
Mm-hmm. And I would say, actually, you know, that it's not necessarily about the color of the provider. What we have found, and I talk about this a lot in my book, is that medical schools are not teaching lactation education right to providers, right? And so you're assuming as a mom that either your pediatrician, who's technically responsible for your infant's nutrition, knows about breastfeeding. Many of them do not. In my research, I found many who only received a couple of hours of training around lactation science for that, or you're thinking your OBGYN, who I realize is only concerned about the contents of your uterus until the uterus is empty, and then that's not their job. And so what has happened is that women's bodies have been, you know, divvied up and split up, and nobody's taking responsibility for the breast. And so you are assuming that somebody knows and nobody knows. And so this is why we need more providers of color or not of color to actually learn about lactation medicine, learn it from the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine, not to go to the quote unquote institute that the infant formula companies are trying to quote unquote educate providers on. That's what we really need, is more providers to take the infant nutrition part of the infant's life more important, not to mention the benefits to mothers. We know Black women have a higher rate of certain breast cancers, which it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and it's always a time for me to remind people that breastfeeding is an important part of breast cancer awareness. It has been proven to reduce the risk of certain cancers, including breast cancers. So these benefits are the things that we need providers to educate themselves on. We need medical schools to step up, and including lactation education as important. Our breasts should not just be the study of science when they're diseased and nobody knows how a healthy lactating breast works. That's ridiculous and it's unacceptable.
And by the way, it's not as easy as it looks.
That's right. Absolutely.
And if you don't have a good lactation specialist, then it can explain how to get started. A lot of people just give up anyway. And when you're shot like out of a cannon from the hospital after 24 hours, from A to Z, you're gone. I don't know when I was lucky. I had a complication. I got to stay in the hospital for a few more days and got to spend some time with a lactation specialist. But I don't know how people do it who are, you know, out of there in 24 hours.
Yeah, our system is broken. And so it's not built to support breastfeeding. And so you really have to put effort in. We talk to moms and we're like, hey, I know you're focused on that stroller and your diaper bag, but you need to have, and you're worried about the music and your candles, but your birth plan needs a feeding plan. And this is a critical part of educating yourself more, you know, equally as important as how you want to push and what music you want to play. But you need to have a feeding plan. And this is something where we are failing mothers terribly. And it's not lost on me that part of this issue is the way that infant formula companies have paid hospitals millions of dollars, backdoor deals, to have the right to market their formula to moms. And that impacts the breastfeeding support that's available, that's been studied and documented. And so, you know, this commercialization of our food system, which we know begins at birth, the commercialization of women's first job as mothers, the food that we uniquely produce, is something that we all need to pay attention to.
Well, it has been a delight talking with you. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Kimberly Seals-Ollers. She is advocates for equity in maternal and infant health and is a co-founder of Black Breastfeeding Week. She's the author of 5 books, including the 2017 title, The Big Letdown, How Medicine, Big Business, and Feminism Undermine Breastfeeding. Thanks again. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Independent private practice doctors are now a minority in the U.S., according to the American Medical Association. The trend has been accelerating nationally and locally in recent years, with specialists and surgeons now joining the ranks. We're going to talk about what this means for patient care and costs. Northeastern University Assistant Professor Brady Post is a health economist who's been studying the trend. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thank you so much for having me.
What do we mean? Many of us grew up with the family doctor and you'd call them for everything. That just doesn't exist anymore, basically.
Well, that's certainly, it's certainly been changing. Yeah, there's this movement towards physicians leaving private practice and joining hospitals to become hospital employees. In my area of research, it's often called hospital physician integration, which is sort of a jargony term. But what it means is just that hospitals are becoming the dominant employers of physicians.
What's in it for the hospitals to do it that way?
Well, that's a good question. I think that there have been a few different theories sort of put out there, but sometimes hospitals, you know, we've seen this before. Back in the 90s, there was a big burst of integration, and there was a sort of a response to managed care, and hospitals wanted to have a little bit tighter control over their over the physicians who worked in their systems. In order to get to have certain referrals, and the idea was that you were going to keep more of the lucrative care in-house, so to speak. So that's at least one of the things that that the hospitals might gain from this would be some referral, guarding the referral base is what it's sometimes said.
And what's in it for the physicians?
That's a good question. I would say at this point we're there's more anecdote than hard evidence on exactly what this what's driving this, but certainly there have been a few different things that have been put forward. So, for example, physicians might prefer more of a work-life balance. There's a lot of work that goes into managing a practice. I mean, you graduate from medical school, you do your fellowship, you've been in school for a really long time. It's hard to just jump right out of the gate and launch a business on top of all of that. These physicians are MDs. Some of them have MBAs, but not that many. And so it's hard to do that. And so a lot of the rationale is that physicians are just, they feel like there's so much administrative complexity and that they got into the business of medicine, not to run a business, but to provide clinical care to patients. That's maybe a compelling reason. Other people have raised the possibility that the cost of electronic health records, for example, might be driving it. It just makes it a little bit more difficult to be in private practice. That there's some sort of advantage to being larger, and so that's some of what's going on. Physicians, I think, are looking for a bit more security and stability. Not everybody wants to work those super long hours where you're on call for your patients nights and weekends. And hospital systems can offer a little bit more stability there.
What about patient care? What's in it for the patient?
Well, that's a great question. I think that the hope is that you could have, well, I guess let's start with this. One of the biggest criticisms of the American healthcare system, of the many that are out there, is that it's fragmented and siloed, and people feel like they don't know, one side is not talking to another. And so I think the big hope for hospital physician integration or this greater alignment between hospitals and doctors is that all your care can be under one roof. That's a very appealing concept. It's like you go to the doctor's office, they're affiliated with your hospital. If you have to have an inpatient stay for whatever reason, then you've got some follow-up care with a doctor that knows what happened in the hospital system. And so it's more streamlined, it's more integrated. There's a ton of interest in having integrating care from across the care continuum or across the care spectrum, people will say. So that's kind of the hope in the long run is that you might have these quality improvements and patient satisfaction that could result from these more integrated arrangements between hospitals and physicians. So I think that's maybe what's in it for patients, although it isn't necessarily all roses.
Oh, I was going to say that's aspirational, but what's the reality?
Well, as an economist, we generally get a little nervous when markets consolidate, and it might be helpful to have a little bit of the context here. So, mm-hmm. This increase in hospital physician integration is a seismic shift in the way that we think about delivering care in the United States. Back in the day, it was that the physicians were completely independent, as you noted, and they would see their patients in the office. They would then do their more complicated stuff in hospitals. It was sometimes called the hospital. Sometimes thought of as the physician's workshop. And all of that is changing. Even in the early 2000s, maybe 15-20% of physicians were employed by hospitals. And as of just, I think, maybe last year, that number has climbed all the way to be past 50%. So there are now more hospital-employed physicians than independent. So this is a huge change in the way that we think about delivery of healthcare in the United States. And what happens in the physician arena is really important. There are about 20% of health spending. And given that health is about 18% of our economy, that means that physicians account for around $600 billion worth of expenditure in healthcare. So that's a big deal. And if we have consolidation in this market, that could have adverse effects on prices. We've seen a lot of different types of consolidation in American healthcare and frankly in the American economy more generally, but we've seen big mergers between CVS and Aetna, big headline grabbing things. We've seen hospitals buy out other hospitals and physician groups growing horizontally and more physicians working with each other. And so that's sort of the backdrop of what's going on here. And generally speaking, economists get nervous when there's too much consolidation because we like choice. We like consumers and in this case, patients to be able to choose from a variety of providers. And that usually helps to have, there's more competition in the marketplace on prices and there's more competition on quality.
How has the Affordable Care Act played a role in all of this?
Oh, that's a great question. So there's been a little bit of research on this at the moment. The concern that there might be, the incentives to integrate in order to respond to some of the programs of the Affordable Care Act, some of that, there doesn't seem to be a particularly strong relationship. But I will say that it seems to, this rate of integration really started to take off in the late 2000s and the early 2010s. So it's been a 10 to 12 year spike, which of course does approximately coincide with the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. And so while there's not a lot of great research that says the Affordable Care Act caused any of this, there could be some aspect of physicians and hospitals wanting to brace for uncertainty by growing in number. There's safety in numbers and there might be some advantage to having a larger resource or a larger resources within an organization in order to prepare for some changes that come down the pipeline.
And then is there any regulation of this trend? Is anybody watching it and saying, like they do with, Securities and Exchange Commission or something, watching mergers and acquisitions and making sure they meet certain muster? Is there anything like that when it comes to the field of medicine?
Yeah, absolutely. That's such a good question. So there are some competition policy watchdogs. There are a couple of organizations, a couple of federal bodies that do pay attention to some of this consolidation in healthcare. So those would be the Department of Justice as a wing that's on antitrust enforcement in healthcare. And then also the Federal Trade Commission does this. However, these organizations often are a little bit tied up. It's a little bit difficult for them to actually prosecute small scale mergers like this. And so when one enormous hospital buys out another enormous hospital, that gets attention. Everybody can see that. People get worried about prices and consumer choice and patient safety and all that kind of stuff. But what we're talking about, this that is so much smaller in scale at an individual level. So you buy out one practice, then you buy out another practice, then you buy out another practice. Each one of those is too small to trigger federal antitrust scrutiny. So one of the policy proposals out there is to reduce that, is to reduce the threshold for mandatory reporting. And this came up actually, and to answer your broader question about whether there are people paying attention to this, the Federal Trade Commission launched an investigation in January of this year. It's a multi-year investigation into this issue specifically of hospital acquisitions of physician practices. And then it also came up in front of the U.S. Senate. They held a hearing on competition policy in healthcare, and hospital physician integration was one of those topics. So there are some agencies that are looking at it, but with the current antitrust framework that we have, it's a little bit hard to enforce. These acquisitions are, sometimes I think of them as sort of like a quiet form of consolidation. You've got the noisy headlines, but this is quieter. But when you th- think about it in aggregate, all of these things taken together, suddenly you're looking at a market that has a lot fewer options for you.
My guest is Brady Post. He's a health economist and assistant professor at Northeastern University. And we are talking about the fact that independent private practice doctors are now a minority in the United States. That's according to the American Medical Association. And the trend has been accelerating nationally and locally in recent years. And there's no reason to believe it won't continue to. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, down on the ground, Brady, tests and other services can be more expensive at hospitals. They have the economies of scale, but so what? If your doctor is employed by a hospital, must you use their facilities? Is there any choice there?
Well, that's a good question. Unfortunately, as in all things, it kind of depends on your insurance. So you can certainly be, there may be like in-network restrictions that make you want to stay with a physician. If you have a broader network, you might be able to shop around services a little bit more. But it's certainly common for physicians who work for a particular organization to want to use services from within that organization. There was a great paper that came out in the Journal of Health Economics that found that once a hospital bought out a physician practice, those physicians became much, much more likely to refer their patients to the owning hospital. And that's consistent with what you might expect when you've got a new employer and you generally have to follow the incentives that employer comes up with. So there may be some patient discretion there. If they're able to seek a lower cost provider, they should consult their like insurance and see what their network options are.
And many doctors employed by hospitals have to meet productivity standards. That is what a lot of us are feeling when we go in to talk to a doctor. We're feeling rushed. They're trying to move people in and out. The number of patients that they're seeing increases. So you said they want to get that work-life balance, but I feel like part of the equation is sort of, I don't know, there must be mixed reaction to that once they get into it.
You're totally right. I think that it's very common for physicians to have productivity targets, and regardless of employment setting, actually. And so in private practice, in particular, like a solo practice, when you're the only doctor in your office, sometimes that's a bit informally or maybe too colloquially known as an eat what you kill model, which means that you can only garner the revenue that you're doing yourself. You might have changes in incentives once you join a hospital system to keep up some of that productivity, those productivity targets. Certainly back in the 90s when hospitals bought up a bunch of primary care doctors, after they became employees, their productivity sort of fell, and a lot of hospitals actually kind of took a bath on it financially, which led to them spinning off some of these practices. So some hospitals may have sort of learned their lesson from last time, and in these employment contracts, which of course are private, and I would love to see them from a research perspective, but they're privately held. Some of those hospitals may have learned their lesson a little bit and have a bit more like productivity built into the contract, that in order to have this level of salary or compensation, we expect that you do certain things. Now, I doubt that it's as strong of incentives as it would be in private practice. I have a little bit of active research on this. I submitted it to an academic journal for review. I actually found that the productivity of physicians fell a little bit, not a ton, but maybe 4 to 7% or so upon becoming hospital integrated. That was one of the findings. You know, that's just a sneak preview. It hasn't been peer reviewed yet, but I'm optimistic for that.
Let's see, real quick question from Barbara in Gahanna. Hi, Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi, just want to relate just a short story. I had surgery, and while I was in the hospital, a doctor stopped in 2 or 3 times to see me, and I hadn't seen him before, but I thought, well, maybe he's a resident or a fellow with the surgical team. And it wasn't until I got home and the bills started rolling in that I realized that this, when I called to challenge the charges, that this individual was what they call a hospitalist. And it's a doctor who's in private practice who goes from hospital to hospital to just fill in when they need someone. And I think this is a real disservice to the patient, because I really had to go through a lot of hoops to get the insurance company to remove the charges, because I had not asked for this person, and yet he just came in. And I would like to let people be aware of them because from what I understand, they're in private practice and they just go to hospitals when they need them. Kind of like traveling nurses, only these are traveling doctors.
Okay.
And I'd like to hear a comment from your from Brady about that.
Okay. Thanks, Barbara.
Thank you.
Yeah. Brady Post.
Thanks, Barbara. Well, you know, there are a lot of different types of arrangements between hospitals and physicians, and so hospitalists are sort of one category, one form of that. And you could have a hospitalist that is in private practice, like you talked about. You might also have one that is fully employed by the hospital, and unfortunately, as you're pointing out, sometimes it's not easy for patients to control who it is that they see when they're in the hospital. So I think, Barbara, that you probably did the right thing to take a close look at your bill and to see how that played out. Hospital physician integration or the greater employment of physicians should have some effects where there's a more consistent care team. But it may not solve all these problems. And it sounds like the hospitalist issue is one of those.
Barbara, thanks for that call. And Brady Post, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Great to be here, Anne.
Brady Post is a health economist and assistant professor at Northeastern University, and he has been studying the trend of independent private practice doctors now being a minority in the U.S., and that's according to the American Medical Association. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. An advisory panel of independent advisors yesterday recommended the Food and Drug Administration grant emergency use authorization for the Pfizer BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine for children ages 5 to 11. Dr. Paul Offit from Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and a member of the advisory panel said he was swayed by the evidence to date.
Never when you know everything, you never know everything. The question is, when do you know enough? And I think we certainly know that there are many children between 5 and 11 years of age who are susceptible to this disease, who could very well be sickened or hospitalized or die from it.
Now the FDA must decide whether to green light the Pfizer vaccine for an estimated 28 million children. Dr. John Swartzberg is chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Welcome back, Dr. Swartzberg.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So this brings 28 million children closer to eligibility for the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. Doctors have raised a number of concerns. One was the number of children studied in the clinical trials. What's your take on what we know so far?
Well, we know so far that these vaccines are incredibly safe in children 12 to 18 and adults 18 and above. We know that in the studies that were done by Pfizer, that the vaccines appeared comparably safe. But the study numbers were small compared to the numbers that we did for 12 to 18 and 18 and above. That said, even though the numbers are small, there really was no biological reason why we would anticipate more problems in 5 to 11-year-olds than we would see in 12 to 18-year-olds. So I'm quite reassured by the data and feel very confident that we've got a vaccine that's also safe for 5 to 11 years old. I would have loved to have seen, instead of around a little 3,000 plus kids receive the vaccine, I would have loved to see 3 million plus. But if we waited for that to happen, we would have had so many children get sick with COVID, so many die, so many hospitalized, so many with long COVID, that would have been unconscionable.
The FDA typically goes along with the advice of its independent expert panels. Any sense of what they're going to do here?
Yeah, I think they're going to sustain the advice of the advisory panel. I will be surprised if they don't. I wouldn't be surprised if we hear today.
Mm-hmm.
Then it goes to the advisory panel for the CDC, which meets next Monday. And they'll go through the same process. That is, the advisory panel will discuss it on Monday and give their advice to the CDC. So if the CDC and the advisory panel go along with what we've heard from the advisory panel to the FDA, then I anticipate that we'll have a vaccine for children, and children can start rolling up their sleeves to get it sometime in the middle or late next week.
Assuming the it's granted the emergency use authorization, what questions do you advise people, parents, be asking pediatricians as they decide whether to vaccinate?
Well, I think the way you framed your question is the key point, and that is ask your pediatrician. Mm. Pediatricians are the most trusted health advisors to American families. They know the data backwards and forwards. They're incredibly experienced with immunizations. They do an awful lot of that, more than any other group of doctors in the United States. So ask your pediatrician about questions that you may have. And, you know, it's very appropriate to have questions. It's very appropriate to say, you know, I feel a little hesitant. This is my child. I wasn't hesitant about myself, but this is my child. Talk to your pediatrician about that. You have every right to do that, and your pediatrician will be more than delighted to help walk you through the process.
How are they changing, or what do you know about how they change the delivery of the vaccination to children compared to adults?
Well, the most important change is that the dosage is a third of what children 12 and above get. So it's a lot smaller dose. And fortunately, but not surprisingly, that smaller dose in very young kids works incredibly well. Young children respond much better to vaccines and much smaller doses of vaccines than older children and adults. So the first thing, the first big change is that the dose is much smaller. And of course, because the vaccine is what's called an intramuscular vaccine, that is, the vaccine is injected into the muscle, the needles are much smaller in children than they are in older kids and adults.
Why can't we get those smaller needles too?
I know. Well, it's because we have a lot of tissue between our skin and our muscles, and we need longer needles.
Okay. Let's see. Bridget and Hilliard, you're on the air with Dr. John Swartzberg. Hi, Bridget.
Hey, my daughter turns 12 in December, and I would like to know, if that vaccine gets approved for kids, should I get her the smaller dose as soon as I can, or wait until January and she gets the adult size dose? And can you mix the kid dose first and the second dose later in January? And does weight matter?
Bridget, that's an incredibly important question, and it's one that everybody is struggling with. I've got a granddaughter who's 11, but she's not going to be 12 until May. So for her parents and her grandparents, my wife and me, she's certainly going to get vaccinated as soon as the vaccine's available, hopefully at the end of next week. But now you're talking about a month or so difference. It's a judgment call, frankly. There's no science to really guide us, but I can give you some ways to think about this. The half dose has been tested, excuse me, the one-third dose has been tested in children up to through the age of 11. So they had children in that group who got it through the age of 11, and those kids responded well to the one-third dose. The risk of waiting a month or 6 weeks before your child is fully immunized is solely the risk of he or she getting COVID in the interim. So what you buy with getting the one-third dose now, what you buy with that is some protection against getting COVID. On the other hand, if your child is 11 now, yes, it's the one-third dose. If your child becomes 12, it'll be the full dose. And I know that seems a little crazy because you were just talking about a matter of weeks, but mm-hmm. a line has to be drawn somewhere. And there's no contraindication to getting a full dose after you've gotten a half dose. So ball's back in your court, Bridget. I'm sorry. Both decisions are really reasonable. Maybe one thing you could do is look at what your plans are over the holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. If you're going to be with, if your child's going to be around people in the family, for example, who are not vaccinated, that's a risky situation. And having he or she protected now might make more sense. On the other hand, if you can pretty much control your child's exposure over the holidays, then maybe waiting would make sense for you. So sorry, I can't give you a definitive answer.
What about weight? I mean, there's a big difference in weight between a 5-year-old and an 11-year-old, all things being equal. And I'm wondering, you know, since it's intramuscular, does that matter?
It doesn't seem to matter. In the studies that were done, the larger 10 and 11-year-olds compared to the 5 and 6-year-olds, they all responded pretty comparably to the vaccine. So it didn't seem to matter. You know, more important than weight is your immune system and how well it responds to a vaccine. And kids up through 11, and actually even older, respond so much better. You know, for example, I got the, I'm over 65, so I got the influenza vaccine. I got the high dose, high potency one because I'm over 65. My immune system just doesn't respond as well as somebody under 65. And kids under 12, under 13, under 14, just younger children, especially under 11, they respond so well. You can just give them a whiff of the vaccine and they'll have a good immune response.
Bridget, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. Let's see. Is it going to be with the Pfizer? It is a 2-shot protocol even for kids, right?
That's right.
Okay. And I wondered, you know, we're running out of time, but I am interested in your thoughts about what you've learned and what, you know, over the last several months now about how COVID behaves in children versus adults. I mean, what do we, it was hard to know before, but we must be getting some data in that's usable at this point.
Yeah, we've actually learned a great deal. The first, you know, during the first phase of the pandemic, there was the question, do children really get infected? And if they get infected, do they really get sick? Well, subsequently, we've learned that children really get infected just about as easily as anybody else. Fortunately, we've also learned that children don't tend to get as sick as older kids, above 12, for example, and certainly as adults. The older you are, the more sick you're likely to get. Age is a risk factor. So we've learned that. We've also learned that children are a reservoir for this virus. That is, that even if they don't get sick at all or they get minimally ill, they can certainly spread it to mom and dad, grandma and grandpa, aunts and uncles, et cetera. So they're an important reservoir for this. The other thing we've learned is that children, although not often, can get sick and they can get awfully sick and they can die. We've seen with Delta a dramatic shift in the number of children getting infected. When Delta hit up through August and early September, there was a 240% increase in the number of kids getting infected with COVID. More kids got infected during the Delta surge than got infected during that horrific surge of last December and January. So Delta spreads beautifully in children. Some children get sick. Some children get hospitalized. Tragically, some children die. And we also see long COVID in children. And we also see that unusual, fortunately not very common, inflammatory condition that occurs after COVID, the multi-system inflammatory syndrome of children. So we've learned that children do get sick. We learned that they can spread the virus. We learned that they're an important reservoir. And we've also learned that we can prevent it in children with the vaccine.
Dr. John Swartzberg, thanks as always for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Ann. It's always fun to be with you.
Dr. John Swartzberg is the chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Thanks so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Sinema started out in politics. She was fighting for immigrant workers in the streets. She was fighting for people who were against the Iraq War. She was fighting against harsh anti-immigration laws. And now she seems to be